last class of the day of the conference.
I think they're getting back at me because I put them on 8 a.m. in our conference. So before I get started, I'd like to get an idea of the audience. How many of you have RO systems as part of your bottling operations? Okay. Anybody working with point-of-use coolers or selling point-of-use coolers also with RO? Okay. The ones that are with the bottling applications, it says key concepts. What are the key concepts that you would like to get out of this class? I'm just curious to see if we're going to ask people anyway. What type of questions do you normally have when you're staring at your bottling treatment system? What comes to mind?
pH control.
pH control? Are you adjusting pH after the RO?
Before
the RO. Okay. For descaling?
Yeah, descaling and pH.
Okay. We're not going to talk about pH.
Okay.
Sorry. anything else? How many of you keep a close eye on the instruments on that RO, monitoring the water flow, monitoring the TES? All right. You ever get to a point where all of a sudden there's a lot more water being produced than there should be? No, okay, you're escaping that one. But you see the TDS rise, right? Okay, so what we're going to talk about today is going to explain a little bit of why that happens. And it looks like a lot of you already understand the importance of monitoring the system. Is there anybody not have any pretreatment equipment in front of the RO? Does everybody usually have a couple of pieces of equipment before then? Yeah? Okay, good.
Because what you probably already know, but I will confirm for you anyway, is that if you're seeing that TDS rise, and maybe rise a little faster than usual, then it's probably something to do with that equipment up front. Okay. So, as I was saying, the reason you're going to see these changes is going to be dependent on how an RO works in the first place. And if you have pretreatment equipment, which in most cases you probably should, knowing that that equipment is operating properly and making sure that it's operating properly is going to help you avoid a lot of the problems. So we're going to start where we always start when talking about water, and that's figuring out what's in it. So in the water, we can have microbiological contaminants, which include viruses, bacteria, protozoa, cysts. What else can we have? If I do all the talking, you guys will fall asleep. What else can we have in the water besides microbiologicals? I'm sorry?
Dirt.
Okay, sediment. So suspended solids. What else? Disinfectant byproducts, so organic molecules. Anything else? I'm sorry, my hearing is...
Hardness.
Bad water.
TDS.
Ions, right? Okay. So yes, we can have all of these. We can have inorganic substances, which will include some of those ions that are coming from minerals. Depending on what your distribution system is made up of, you can have some corrosion products. The disinfectant residuals are in the wrong category. They should be under organics. But you can also, again, depending on your source water, there might be synthetic organics, there might be volatile organics, there might be tannins, and the suspended solids that were mentioned at the beginning. So what an RO is capable of doing is taking out those suspended solids and the macromolecules and the salt. In fact, it can take out just about everything. Just about everything. It's good with protozoa, with the cysts. Not so great with viruses. Viruses are too small. It'll take out the synthetic organics, but not the volatiles, because the gas is going to diffuse through the membrane. It'll take out the ionized minerals. It'll take out the corrosion products. So everything that you see here in green, it will definitely take out the items in brown, such as bacteria and the personal care products, the endocrine disrupting chemicals. That's questionable. You can use RO for bacteria in an emergency. You wouldn't want to use it long term. Bacteria has been known to grow through the membrane and end up in your product water. The PCPs, EDCs, I'm going to address a little bit later on, because although they're organic, although they tend to be large molecules, whether or not they're ionized or polar is going to play a big role into how well RO can remove them. So this is what can be removed by RO. The question is what should be removed by RO. And this is why you have all those pieces of pretreatment equipment. You shouldn't be using the reverse osmosis for microbiological treatment. You really shouldn't be using it for organics, because those organics are going to build up on the membrane. That's what the carbon in front of the RO system is for. The carbon will also catch the tannins and disinfection byproducts, etc. It may not get some of those personal care products. You should definitely not be using RO if you have high concentration of the divalent minerals, so calcium carbonate, magnesium carbonate. If you are, and I apologize, I forget exactly what the limit is, but those will also build up on the membrane, and that's what's going to cause your production volume to really drop. So instead, the pretreatment in front of the RO, such as a water softener, is going to be able to address that. Corrosion products, depending on how much you have and what form they're in, if they're ionized, like it or not, if you've got a softener out there, the softener is going to catch it. Getting it back off the softener is a little bit more of a problem. If it's in colloidal form, maybe the carbon will get it, but more than likely it will end up being stopped by the RO. Heavy metals and the industrial waste, again, if they're ionized, more than likely they'll get caught by the softener. Anything that the softener doesn't catch, anything in trace amounts is that gets out of the softener is going to be stopped by the RO. So that huge list of everything that the RO could take out really gets narrowed down significantly. Really, it's a polishing technology. After you've taken out everything that you can with other treatment technologies. So your typical bottling system, bottling treatment train, is going to look something like this. You're going to have a sand filter for the suspended solids, carbon filter to catch the organics, any chlorine residuals. You're going to have a softener to take out the cations. You might have an anion system to catch those, depending on the concentration. Sometimes it makes more sense to have the RO take care of things like nitrates. And you're going to have a guard filter in front of the pump, and that's to catch any sediment or any parts from the resin, et cetera, that may have gotten out of the resin tank. You're going to have the filter there to protect both the pump and the RO. And you might have some ozone on the exit. So now that you've got the pretreatment taken care of, let's talk about how the osmosis and reverse osmosis part of the system works. So let's start with what osmosis is. If we take a basin of water, anybody see this in high school with the balloon? You take a basin of water, teacher fills the balloon with salt, suspends it, and the water rushes into the balloon blows up? Maybe? Okay. But if we take a basin of water that has dissolved minerals in it, and we put in a semi-permeable membrane, so that now we have separation between two sides of the basin, and we add more salt to one side than the other, where so that we have lower concentration over on the right and higher concentration on the left, nature dictates the water level is going to rise. Well, physics dictates that the water level is going to rise such that the concentration on both sides is equivalent. This is osmotic pressure. And because we're going in the opposite direction, right, reverse osmosis, this is what the applied pressure in our systems has to overcome. This tendency of the water to rise, to dissolve the salts. Osmotic pressure can be estimated if at about 1 psi for every 100 milligrams per liter if we're talking about monovalent salts, so sodium chloride will give you about 1 psi. If we're looking at divalent salts, so calcium carbonate, magnesium carbonate, or bicarbonate, that is going to be half a psi. So if we're going in the opposite direction, if we're looking at reverse osmosis, we're going to put pressure on the side with the dissolved salts to push the water over to the side without any salts. And of course, some of the salt will go over as well. So here's what it might look like if we have an example of an actual system. We have feed water coming in. Pressure is applied, the fresh water is getting pushed through the membrane, and then we have a turbulent flow at the membrane, which is carrying those dissolved solids over into the concentrate and out to waste. So here's another illustration. Here's the membrane. There's pressure being put on top, kind of if you think about it, being put onto the surface of the screen. The feed water is coming in over on the left, whoops, and the concentrate is going out on the right. The permeate is the water that's getting pushed through the membrane at the top and bottom. Now notice the accumulation of dissolved substances over near the concentrate side. So there's a gradient that's formed as the water moves through that membrane module. Here's another look at it. So if we have our membrane module over here and the feed water coming in, there's considerably more concentration at the end. So if you ever pull out a membrane module and take a look at it, you'll see that one side looks a little dirtier than the other. So here's another example of what that membrane module might look like inside a pressure vessel. So here's our pressure vessel over on the right. We have the membrane wrapped around the permeate tube. The permeate tube, if you can see here, oh, you can't see my mouse. I'm moving here over. The permeate tube has holes in it that collects the water that's been pushed through the membrane. And over on the right-hand side are the two exit streams, the permeate on the bottom and the concentrate on the top. So now that we know kind of what a membrane looks like and where all the water goes, what happens to the product water quantity? Excuse me. So what controls that? We have to put the pressure on top of the module, onto the module, in order to push the water through the membrane. Remember, if there's no pressure, the water is actually going to want to go in the other direction. Anything that's external to ends up external to the membrane with the in contact with the concentrate is going to want to try and come back. So you put pressure on to push the water through the membrane. And how much water you get during the day or at any particular period of time is going to depend on how quickly that particular membrane can process water. It's also going to depend on the pump pressure. In order to produce water, there has to be a specific net driving pressure. And the net driving pressure is the pressure being produced by the pump minus that osmotic pressure. So the osmotic pressure, if you remember, is based on the concentration of salts in your feed water. That's what's trying to create the osmosis effect rather than the reverse osmosis. That's what you're pushing against. And then also the P sub BP is the back pressure. So in order to have an operating pressure, we're creating pressure with the pump, subtracting the osmotic pressure and subtracting any back pressure from a storage tank. If you have a point of use cooler or even a point of use under the sink RO that comes with a storage tank, there's going to be back pressure. If you are collecting water and your pressure tank is at a considerable distance from your RO system, you're going to have back pressure as a result. Or if you're trying to pump into an elevated tank, that's going to provide back pressure. But in most RO systems, there's not going to be any back pressure from that tank because it's not elevated and it's not very far away. Okay, so if, in most bottling applications. So the only thing really that we're looking at is that P sub OP, which is the operating pressure, and we're looking at the osmotic pressure that's pushing back. Now, how well your membrane is going to operate is going to depend on that operating pressure. It's also going to depend on what the manufacturer has rated it for. Here are a couple examples of membranes from a manufacturer, and they're telling you that the permeate flow rate for that top model is 2,600 cubed meters per day. Nope, sorry, 2,600 gallons per day. The cubed meters are in parentheses. So 9.8 cubed meters per day. But notice at the bottom that there are very specific conditions under which this was determined. The temperature was at 77 degrees Fahrenheit or 25 degrees C. The percent recovery is 15. And the applied pressure in this particular case was 100 PSIG. So by applying that 100 PSIG at 25 degrees Celsius, you can get the 2,600 gallons per day. If you're applying a higher pressure and you haven't changed your temperature, what's going to happen? Is your production going to go up or down?
Say that again.
If you're applying a higher pressure than the 100 PSIG, are you going to get more than 2,600 gallons per day or less?
More.
You're going to get more. Production's going to go up. What about, how typical is 77 degrees Celsius for your operations? No, usually it's lower than that, right? Especially if you're on well water, especially if it's the winter and you're in a location that experiences the seasons, you might get 60 degrees. You might get 50 degree water. If your temperature goes down, if the water temperature goes down, what happens to those 2,600 gallons a day? Did they go up or down? They're going to go down. Okay, so when you are trying to evaluate the performance of your system, or you're putting in a new system, you're trying to figure out what it's going to be able to give you, you need to take a look at what the manufacturer has rated it for and the parameters that they've used in order to come up with that rating. And you need to make adjustments. So just to summarize, as the pressure on the membrane module increases, the permeate flow rate is also going to increase. As the temperature increases, permeate flow rate is going to increase. And if the membrane gets fouled, what happens to the permeate flow rate? It's going to go down. All right, here's an example of some correction factors that you might that you'd be able to apply to the temperature to figure out those gallons per day. So let's say if we're at 50 degrees Celsius, I'm sorry, 50 degrees Fahrenheit, our correction factor is 0.63. So we're going to take those 2,600 gallons per day, multiply it by the 0.63, and you'll see that actual production is going to be closer to 1,600 gallons per day. All right, everybody said that they were monitoring their systems. So what happens if over time you see a permeate flow that goes up like that. What do you think's going on? What else? It's what? There are holes in the membrane. Anything else? Okay, I was going for the holes in the membrane. What does that mean? How do holes form in the membrane? What's a big culprit? I'm sorry?
Pressure. Too high of an operating pressure? Anything else?
What if the chlorine got by the carbon filter? That's assuming it didn't turn the resin to mush afterwards and got past the resin. But there's another possibility. Okay, so as that happens, as the permeate flow goes up, more than likely you're going to see your TDS go up as well. On the other hand, if the permeate flow goes down, what's happening? Membrane's getting fouled, probably clogged up. All right, so coming back to what your system is supposed to produce, we talked about what's responsible for the volume of water you're going to get. Let's take a look at what's going to be responsible for the water quality that you're going to get in the permeate. I'm sure you're all familiar with percent rejection. That's what the membrane does. It rejects those dissolved substances. You can calculate percent rejection by looking at the concentration in the product, concentration of the dissolved substances in the product water and dividing it by the concentration in the feed water. So part over whole, and multiply by 100 to get percent. So where are you going to use it? Well, let's say you've got a water source that has 78 milligrams per liter nitrate. What's the allowed in the U.S.? What's the allowed concentration in drinking water?
Less than 10.
Less than 10. See, you don't need my slides. All right, and typical membrane rejection is going to be 93% at that 77 degree mark with the 100 PSIG pressure applied. So keep in mind it's going to vary. So if you have a water source that is over the MCL in nitrate, your question might be, well, okay, if I'm bottling this stuff, how well is my system going to be able to treat for it? And the way you can calculate that out to find the concentration in the product or in the permeate is we're going to subtract the percent rejection from 1. So if our percent rejection is 15, right, that means that 0.15, all right, let's do it differently. Out of every 100 molecules that we're trying to reject, 15 are getting through. Got my numbers wrong. I hate it that they're recording me. I'm sorry. Percent rejection is 93%. So if we've got 100 molecules of salt, 7 of them are getting through, right? And the way we would figure this out in terms of how much of that 78 milligrams per liter is going to come through is we'll take the 78, we'll multiply it by the 0.07 that we're going to get out of that equation, and we're going to see our result. So we'd be getting 5.4 milligrams per liter still coming through the system, but now we're within the MCL. What if the 5.4 wasn't acceptable? What if you wanted to do better? What would you have to add to your configuration? I'm sorry?
Do it again?
You could do some ROs in series. But okay, so that one's got a 93%. Your next one has a 93% rejection. What's left over? You still have a little bit of something carrying over. What's another option? I'm sorry?
Temperature.
Filter?
Temperature?
No, temperature won't help you. Come on. What are you going to put in front of that RO? You put an anion system in front of it. Okay? And then you're going to use the RO to catch anything that might get past the anion. Okay, so one other thing to consider. You guys run your RO systems 24 hours a day? Yes? No. Some do. Okay, so you don't have to worry about this. But when you come in the morning and you turn on that RO, what are you going to get? You're going to get excess TDS, right? So you have to flush it. And why is that happening? Well, it's because when you don't have that pressure pushing on the RO system, when you don't have the feed water coming through, you're going to get equilibrium effects. And the equilibrium effects are going to, they're always operating. You just don't notice them because there's so much water washing through the permeate. But you're going to get more salt coming through that membrane. And that's because there's a difference in concentration between what's inside your membrane vessel and what is able to go into the permeate or what has gone into the permeate. And how quickly does this happen? Well, there's an equation for that. So J sub S is the rate with which the salt passes. It's dependent on the permeability coefficient for that salt for a particular membrane. So this is something you have to get from your manufacturer. And it's dependent on the concentration gradient, the difference in concentration between what's in the membrane module, what's sitting in the membrane module, and what's come out into the permeate. But what you don't see here is anything that has to do with pressure. Actually, you don't see temperature here as well, but it should be. But the pressure is not here. So salt passage is independent of the pressure. Salt passage is strictly dependent on the concentration difference. If you increase the temperature, yes, there will be a little bit more of the salt passage simply because of kinetics or thermodynamics. Yeah. Okay, so as the concentration gradient increases, the amount of salt passage is going to increase. So far we've talked about ionic substances and RO rejecting those. What if you do get organic substances that you need to reject? If you remember, I pointed out that if you have those pharmaceuticals that might be in the recycled water that you're using, and yes, in even municipal water, it is actually recycled, you might be getting those endocrine disruptors, which the carbon filter is not going to catch, the softener is not going to catch, and certainly the sediment filter is not going to catch either. Can the RO treat for those? Potentially. Whenever we talk about organics and reverse osmosis, we always focus on size, right? What's the minimum size that an RO can reject for an organic molecule? Anybody? Okay, maybe size isn't quite the right word. What's the minimum molecular weight that can be rejected? It would be 100 atomic mass units, 100 Daltons. So to give you an example, something like chloroform, which is one carbon and three chlorine atoms, and I can't do math in my head. Carbon is 12, chlorine's 35. So that's 70, about 100, a little over 120. Something around those lines. So in theory, chloroform should get rejected by an RO membrane. But it doesn't. No, and we're going to talk about why. So when talking about organics, it's important to recognize that it's more than the size. Molecular volume, how much space that molecule occupies, makes a difference. Whether that molecule is hydrophobic or hydrophilic, does it like water? Does it like to? Is it more like oil and water, hydrophobic? Is it polarizable? So chloroform, for example, is polarizable. I wish I had drawn it for you. Just like water has a slightly positive end, slightly negative end, same thing happens with chloroform. Can the substance be ionized? And some organics are ionizable and do ionize in water. That also has an effect on how well they're rejected. So according to some research, this is about the trend. So what we have on the left side is percent rejection. On the bottom are the different substance characteristics. So if we have an ionizable organic, something that's going to form ions, it's going to get rejected just as well as the inorganic ions are going to get rejected. If something has the behavior with water like oil does, where it doesn't want to be anywhere near water, that's going to get rejected pretty well, assuming you're over that 100 Dalton limit. However, if something is slightly hydrophilic, it's got a little bit of that polarity characteristic where it can split into, okay, where it can have two different poles, slightly positive, slightly negative, the RO membrane doesn't do all that well with that. On the ionizable side, that means that some of the disinfection byproducts, such as the haloacetic acids do dissociate in water, those are going to be well rejected. Something like ibuprofen, because it also ionizes in water, is going to be well rejected. On the hydrophobic side, something like carbon tetrachloride, carbon tetrabromide will be rejected. And chloroform, bromoform, which is also a disinfection byproduct, is going to get right through. Notice the molecular weights. That even though the haloacetic acids, particularly the chlorinated forms, are around 150 in their molecular weight, 150 Daltons, they're going to get rejected better than the carbon tetrabromide, which is at 332. They're going to get rejected better than the bromoform at 253. So it's not just the molecular weight. I mentioned that molecular volume can also indicate rejection capability. And in fact, it's a better indicator than the molecular mass. Did not spell these out. So I'm going to avoid going through the abbreviations other than to point out that the BF is bromoform, TCE is tetrachloroethane. Notice that while their molecular weights are very different, 253 and 131, their molecular volumes, are pretty close. So the bromoform actually gets rejected a little better, but almost identical to the tetrachloroethane. So the molecular weight, again, less of a factor than the molecular volume. All right, let's move on to percent recovery. So we've talked about water quantity. We've talked about water quality. Percent recovery gets us back to that water quantity. It also talks about the efficiency of our system. So percent recovery is how much of that product water are you getting by comparison to the amount of feed water that you're putting through. All right, again, part over whole times 100 to give you the percent. So if we're getting a gallon of product water for every 10 gallons of feed water coming in, that means we're getting how much recovery? 10%. Okay, so we're getting 1 gallon of product for every 10 gallons used times 100, 10%. All right, what if we have 200,000 gallons of feed water coming in and we've got a 15% recovery? Get out your calculators. guys are better at math in your head than I am. All right, so you should have gotten 30,000 gallons. Again, we're taking that 200,000, multiplying it by the 0.15 from the 15% recovery, getting 30,000 gallons out. So what does this mean when you're trying to put together a system? Let's say your bottling plant is going to bottle 1,200 gallons of RO water per day. What does your system need to be able to feed through that RO to get those 1,200 gallons a day if your RO is operating at 15% recovery?
800,000.
I'm sorry?
800,000.
Almost. Okay, so to get the answer, you can take the volume of the product water, and start with the percent recovery formula, which is the volume of the product water by the volume of the feed water times 100. Going to rearrange it, solve for the feed water. So 8,000 gallons. That's okay. I have that problem too. Yeah. I always end up with the decimal point in the wrong place. Never in my favor either, especially when I'm writing out the checks. Okay, so if you're trying to purchase new equipment and you're planning out your operation and you know how much water you want to be able to bottle during the day, then you need to have an idea of how much, first of all, water you can get into the system. All right, keep in mind that this 15% recovery is coming off of that 77 degrees Fahrenheit rating and the 100 PSIG. Yours might be a little different, but it's a good starting point. Now, you figured out how much, typically this is a little closer to where you're starting with when you're trying to figure out the equipment size. You know that you need to process 8,000 gallons per day. You know that your plant is going to operate from 8 to 5. And you need to produce 400 gallons every 2 hours because you're putting it into a storage tank so that you can get a reasonable, regular flow out to the bottling portion. So what is the minimum processing rate of the membrane that you're going to need to have with a 15% recovery? All right, you don't want to do the math, do you? Okay. So you know that you need 400 gallons every 2 hours. That's much more critical than the 8,000 gallons per day number. That means that you're getting 100 gallons every hour of the product water. With a 15% recovery, that means you need something that's making that can process 667 gallons per hour. But that's not how those membranes are rated. They're rated in gallons per day, right? So if you need to be able to process 667 gallons per hour, and there are 24 hours in a day, means that you need a membrane that can process 16,000 gallons per day. Well, if you recall, the membrane can process 2,600, one module. All right, so 200 gallons per hour, which gives us, about 1,300 gallons per hour of the feed water with the recovery and 1,000 gallons per day. So if one module, you were running 9 hours from 8 to 5, but the membrane is rated by the manufacturers for gallons per day. So, right. So when it's telling you that it can do 2,600 gallons per day, it means that it can do 2,600 gallons over a 24-hour period. So if one module can only get 2,600 gallons, how many modules do you need? And since the number of gallons per day should be 3,200, that means that we're going to need 14 modules. Okay, make sense? Okay, so you know that you're going to, I'm missing another zero. I told you I was bad with those decimal points. All right, so 32,000 gallons per day is what's needed. A module will make 2,600. If we use multiple modules, we can get more water going through. Okay.
This was not the same scenario
as the previous one, no.
I got it now. Sorry about that.
Okay. All right, so now you've got your system. You know that if you've got 78 milligrams per liter of nitrates that you can process, you're going to get those 5.4 milligrams per liter out. That's acceptable to you. Now the question becomes, what is your discharge going to look like? And what is the community that you're in going to allow? Unfortunately, I don't know what the communities allow, but I'm going to show you how to calculate the discharge, and hopefully all the decimal points and factors are in the right places for this one. All right, we talked about salt passage, the fact that it's going to be dependent on the concentration gradient. Well, the salt is going to continue to pass into your system regardless of anything else that's going on, so we can use that as a starting point. The other thing we need to know is what is the volume of wastewater, because we're going to be able to calculate how much salt is going to end up in the permeate, how much will go into the wastewater. And we're going to have the volume of wastewater, because typically what the community is concerned about is how much wastewater are you sending down the drain and how much of the concentrated health hazard is in it. So if our feed water has 78 milligrams per liter of nitrates as nitrogen, 93% rejection rating, that means 7% is going to end up in the permeate. The remaining 93% is going to be in the concentrate, which we're throwing out. System recovery is 15%. And the plant processes 1,000 gallons per day. So if we're seeing 1,000 gallons per day, 15% of that is going to be the permeate. The remaining 85% is going to be the wastewater. That should be a fairly easy calculation. So what's the volume of wastewater that's going to be generated daily? Trying to find that calculation, but anyway, 850, right? Yes? Okay. So we've got 850 gallons. How much nitrate is going to be in it? There's a concentration factor that can be calculated to figure out what the amount of the dissolved substance that ends up in the concentrate is going to be. Not only the amount, in fact, but what the concentration is going to be, right? Because we're taking away 7% of the water, or sorry, 15% of the water, and we're being left with 93% of the salts. So if we're taking away 15% of the water, that means our concentration factor is 1.18, because we're going to subtract the percent recovery as a decimal from 1, and we're going to put that in the denominator and divide it into 1. That's going to give you the concentration factor. If we have 93% rejection, that means that 7% is going into the permeate. The remaining 93% of that 78 is staying in the concentrate, 72.5 milligrams per liter. The concentrate volume is smaller. than the original volume we're starting with, that's where the concentration factor comes in. So if the municipality wants to know not the amount of nitrate that you're putting down the drain every day, but it wants to know what the concentration of it in your wastewater is going to be, that's where you use the concentration factor, is you take what's going to be in the concentrate, multiply it by that concentration factor, and you will see that the concentration in the wastewater will be 85.6 milligrams per liter. All right, so the concentration, 85.6 milligrams per liter, volume of wastewater, 850 gallons per day, right, using the percent recovery. So how much actual nitrate are we discharging on a daily basis? Well, if we know that 850 gallons per day in each one of those, each liter of that amount has 85.6 gallons, or, 85.6 milligrams. If we convert the liters to gallons, we'll see that there are 324 milligrams, or 0.324 grams, in every gallon of the wastewater. We know there are 850 gallons. That means that there are 276 gallons per day that you're putting down the drain. Grams, yes. Last class of the day. Mm-hmm. All right, I did go through that pretty quickly. Any questions? If you'd like a copy of the slides, I'd be happy to send them to you.